Today, what does the emerging jobs crisis mean for the UK?
One of the pleasures of the job, one of the really great pleasures, is it is really satisfying making something out of nothing.
For more than 30 years, Paul Fryett has worked as a dental technician in Middlesbrough.
Every single crown only ever fits that patient and that tooth that you make it for. The gold crown, it's melted at over 1,000 degrees, and then it doesn't really look like anything up until the last stage where you polish it up, and then this lovely bright yellow gold crown comes into view. You can give someone like this lovely smile, you know, that they've always coveted all their life.
It's a job he's had since he finished school. He's good at it, and it's always paid the bills.
I was always quite comfortable in work from 1985 right up until like 3 years ago.
In recent years, he had to change employers a few times. But at the start of 2020, things were looking up for Paul.
In January, it was really good. The lab I'd been working at the last couple of years, it was a really nice atmosphere. It was really nice to actually sit at the bench and just be able to get on with work. Things were looking really, really good and positive at the beginning of this year.
But now, as the UK enters its deepest recession on record, Paul's career is in jeopardy. And he's not alone. Since the start of the coronavirus crisis, the country has shed almost 750,000 jobs. From The Guardian, I'm Mythili Rao. Today in Focus, Britain's growing unemployment crisis. Aditya, if I were to have asked you back in January how the British economy was doing, in terms of employment, where were we at the start of this year?
It's a funny old picture, Mythili, because if you cast your mind back to before the pandemic, the British labour market looked like it was doing pretty well.
Aditya Chakraborty is The Guardian's senior economics commentator.
Workers were in jobs. We were pretty close to full employment. And if you were a Conservative minister, there were figures that you could point to say, look, the jobs market is humming along.
He should pay tribute to all the people who by their hard work have found fantastic jobs over the last year. And he should pay tribute to the growth in employment in the UK economy. And quite frankly,
the thing is this. Actually, we'd been through over a decade beforehand in which the average British worker hadn't seen their wages go up beyond where they were at the time of the great banking crash of 2008. And the other thing that really concerned people like me was this growth of precarious work, temporary agency work, 0 hours contracts, very, very low wages, very little in the way of protections for the people doing them. Think of your Deliveroo driver. That kind of work was really taking off. Then come forward to January, February 2020. It looked pretty close to people like me that the economy was heading for something that would feel like a recession.
The latest data shows a contraction at the beginning of the year, defying analysts' expectations of growth.
The world economy seemed to be slowing down. There were worries about Brexit, of course. Things generally weren't that healthy. And that was the state of the UK before the pandemic came along.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
Obviously, everything changed dramatically when the coronavirus arrived and we went into lockdown. Suddenly, huge sections of the economy completely shut down.
We are collectively telling cafes, pubs, bars and restaurants to close and not to open tomorrow.
Soon after that, we all remember the whole variety of economic relief measures announced by Boris Johnson's government. And the key one was Chancellor Rishi Sunak's furlough scheme.
I have a responsibility to make sure that we protect as far as possible people's jobs and incomes. Today, I can announce that for the first time in our history, the government is going to step in and help to pay people's wages.
Can you tell me a little bit about how that was supposed to work?
It was a hugely dramatic moment. Under the furlough scheme, rather than your employer making you unemployed, they say, no, we're furloughing you. You don't have to come into work anymore. And 80% of your wages, up to a certain limit, will get paid by the government. So it's effectively a huge government subsidy to employees across the country so that they don't get laid off, they don't lose their skills, and they don't go through the misery of being unemployed. It was a response to a particular problem posed by a COVID hit economy, which is essentially this. We're going into this long period in which normal economic activity just can't continue. It's not that people who get laid off can go and find other jobs. Other companies aren't hiring. Because the whole point of trying to deal with the virus is that economic activity has to stop.
I mean, the furlough scheme sounds terrific. So what's the catch?
Simply put, it's expensive. It's hugely expensive. Having the government pay 80% of wages for 9.5 million jobs costs something like £14 billion a month.
£14 billion a month.
£14 billion. Count those zeros. Yes, it's a lot of money, but you're preventing an awful lot of social and economic damage and an awful lot of political instability too by keeping people in work and they're not all laid off at the same time in a jobs market where there are no jobs to be had.
Initially, this furlough scheme was very well received across the political spectrum. But as time goes on and this £14 billion bill per month keeps coming in, has there been pressure to end it?
Basically, come July of this year, Rishi Sunak faced two competing pressures. On the one hand, there's the public who are obviously sensing that the world has changed dramatically and that if they're to get laid off, they wouldn't necessarily have a job that they could find at all, let alone find it easily. And then behind him, there's this raft of Conservative backbenchers who are putting pressure on the cabinet, on Matt Hancock, on Boris Johnson, on Rishi Sunak himself, to try and get back to business as usual. And by that, they want economic activity to resume. They want the lockdown to be lifted. And they want companies to see how many of their workers they actually need and how many they need to lay off.
I'm sure I'm not the only member who has heard from employers struggling to fulfil orders because it's difficult to get employees back from furlough.
You get to the middle of July, and what Rishi Sunak stands up and says is, well, look, we're going to continue the furlough scheme for a bit longer, but from August, I'm going to start withdrawing government support bit by bit, so that companies are going to have to pay a bit more if they want to keep workers on furlough. And then at the end of October, I'm going to shut it down entirely, come what may.
We have to be honest. Leaving the furlough scheme open forever gives people false hope that it will always be possible to return to the jobs they had before. And the longer people are on furlough, the more likely it is their skills could fade and they will find it harder to get new opportunities.
Soon after that announcement from Rishi Sunak, Paul Fryett got some news from his employer in Middlesbrough.
The Thursday I'd been asked to go in and do a day's work, which I thought looked quite positive, so I said it wasn't a problem, even though me and my wife had just had a baby. And while I was there, the people who owned the lab said they still had plans for me and they were going to try it as the work came in, sort of integrate me back for like a day or 2 days in the future. Then the next week on the Wednesday, I just received an email as we were sat late on the evening saying just because of the difficult circumstances with COVID-19 that I was being made redundant.
An email?
An email, yeah.
How did that feel?
Terrible, really. I've got a terrible sinking feeling in my stomach and quite sickening, really. Especially as it gave me 2 days' notice, which would have made it a day short of my 2 years I would have been working there. So they've tried to make it that they wouldn't have to give me any redundancy compensations as well.
Oh my goodness. When you got that email, what did you do?
It's a father and son who both own it. And we went to collect my tools on the Friday morning and they were both in and they were just sat in there and never spoken to me. So I collected my tools and a few things off my bench. And as I was sort of struggling out the door with them, said, was I okay? I was just struggling to get the door open. One of them came and opened the door. And as I went through, just closed the door behind me and didn't even say goodbye or thank you. Or he was sorry that I had to go or anything. So it was a bit of a bitter bitter end to it all, really.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
No, you're okay.
The ditcher, we heard from Paul Fryett there, a dental technician in Middlesbrough, who seems to have experienced the consequence of that decision in some ways. He was among the original beneficiaries of that furlough scheme. And then very recently, as he told us, without much notice at all, he was suddenly made redundant. Does that story sound familiar to you?
My real worry, Mithili, is that there are going to be millions of Paul Fryetts across the country over the next few months.
When we look at the total number of people who are in paid employment, we now see that that is falling very sharply indeed, down by 730,000 over the last few months. So a very big fall.
In the past 2 days alone, some 12,000 job losses have been announced, most of them in high street retail and aviation, two of the sectors hardest hit by the lockdown.
And now there's more bad news from the high street. Boots, a huge employer, has announced it's cutting about 4,000 jobs. That's around 7% of the workforce. It blames footfall. That's the number of people in shops.
If you look at the official forecasts, we could be even next year with something like 3.5 million people unemployed, possibly 4 million.
Paul told me that he remembered the downturn of the Thatcher years very vividly. And actually, I thought it was so interesting that seeing that as a young man had really kind of shaped his entire career trajectory.
It was right in the middle of the Thatcher years in the mid-80s. It seems quite a long time ago. Now, I was planning on doing my A-levels and going to university, but the miners' strikes had just finished. There was mass unemployment, especially in the northeast where I live, in Middlesbrough. A lot of my friends at school had all gone onto the dole. I remember them being pretty dark days. My parents encouraged me to sort of leave college and take an apprenticeship on. That's what I did. It just seemed getting a job offer at that time was a rarity.
Can you take us back to the early 80s? I mean, what happened to the economy and why?
I think for a lot of people of Paul's generation and older, the recession of the early 80s and the mass unemployment that it triggered remains something they still think about decades later.
Today in Brighton, the Conservatives debated employment, or if you prefer, how to deal with unemployment of over 3 million.
All our policies are designed to make for industrial recovery and prosperity and to increase the number of genuine jobs available for British people.
Miners fight police outside Parliament, 120 arrested.
3.27 million people were unemployed in the summer of 1984. 12% of all workers in the UK were out of a job. It was terrible. Effectively, you had a huge number of layoffs, but they were actually quite geographically concentrated. You can call the 1980s unemployment wave almost the full Monty unemployment crisis, in that the kind of workers who were laid off in that period were very like the characters depicted in the film.
We're finished, Dave. Extincto. Yesterday's news.
Shut it. Some of us are trying to get a job. Hey, and it says no smoking.
You forget, Gerald, you're not our foreman anymore. You're just like the rest of us. Scrap.
They were men. They were often middle-aged. They were employed in heavy industry. And as their employers were disappearing, so were their jobs. So you're talking about places like Middlesbrough, where Paul's from, places in the South Wales valleys with the mining there. Those workers were effectively told that not only were there no jobs for them, their industries and their entire ways of life were now redundant.
How different is all that from what we're seeing today?
Well, the sad thing is that if you look at the official projections, in scale at least, it's going to be as bad. The Office for Budget Responsibility is talking about unemployment peaking at something like 1 in 8 workers being unemployed by the end of this year. And next year, 3.5 million workers being out of work. We've never seen a jobs crisis like this, nor have we seen a jobs crisis after the kind of credit boom that Thatcher and her successors have allowed to happen in the UK. So you've got potentially lots of workers with a fair amount of debt going into this crisis and no real sign of where they're going to get their jobs from.
And Aditya, I asked Paul how his job search was going.
On the dental side of things, there doesn't seem to be anything at all. So it just comes down to what people are looking for. My wife sort of written a CV out for me, and I'm starting to send my CV out to a few places, one of them being a supermarket, just in case I can just go and do some short-term work. And like I say, as of Monday, I'm not earning any money at all, so maybe just to pay some bills, but I'm a bit lost. I think with what's happening in the country, there's going to be an awful lot of people looking for jobs at the same time.
Does that make you eager to get a job quickly?
If I could have gotten a job for Monday morning, I'd have gone straight out and worked Monday morning if I could.
Let's talk about what this job crisis means for someone like Paul. He told us he'd never been unemployed before. He's very eager to get back to work. But as you point out in your recent column, that's true of a lot of people right now who are finding themselves laid off for the first time and looking for work. What's it like to be looking for a job right now?
Desperate. Near on impossible. There are vacancies which are just evaporating. And I got a really close-up example of that while reporting the column. I spoke to a lady called Emily Pringle, who runs a firm called Notes of Northumberland, which is a seller of reed diffusers, smelly candles, you know, nice stuff that you want to have at home, right? And at the end of June, she advertised a part-time job, just 16 hours a week, working mainly in the shop. That's the kind of job for which you might ordinarily expect 40-odd applications. This time, within a fortnight, she had almost 600 people writing in.
600?
And the thing about them is that they were different from the kind of applications that you might normally expect. She had applications from people who were living more than 30 miles away. The vast majority of people that were writing in were hugely overqualified. And she says that a good number of them had PhDs. The thing about Emily Pringle and her experience is there are loads of those stories now going on across the UK. A Manchester restaurant that looks for a receptionist, and within 24 hours, almost 1,000 people apply. A pub in South London wants 2 bar staff, and it gets 500 candidates. I mean, the kind of desperation that you're seeing reflected in those numbers is only going to grow, and you can expect loads more of those stories between now and Christmas.
Who is going to be hardest hurt in this downturn?
When you're talking about 1 in 8 workers being unemployed, that affects nearly everyone. The chances are that everyone listening to this is going to know someone, and perhaps more than one person, who's going to be badly hurt during this jobs crisis. But you can see already in the figures that there are certain industries and sectors which are going to be worse hit than others. This time round, the face of the 2020 depression is as likely to be young, female, and perhaps working in the restaurant trade.
In terms of what this means for a generation, there are long-term consequences to being laid off, aren't there?
What previous recessions have told us is that if you're unemployed, the job that you find next never really pays you the same amount as the one you were made redundant from. Economists do talk about a kind of residual section of the population who will remain unemployed. And those are typically young people whose unemployment rate is at least double that of the rest of the population. Black and minority ethnic workers, again, who've got a much higher unemployment rate than their white counterparts, and women. So the generation going into the jobs market now faces a much more daunting, much more uphill task. First of all, in getting a job, but then in the kind of wages and in the kind of terms and conditions they might expect once they're in the jobs market.
Many of these people will be finding themselves relying on the benefit system, possibly for the first time.
It's really hard to sort of accept. Like I said, I've been working since 1985 and I've never, ever been out of work since. And when my wife's had a look at the Universal Credit, which is what it looks like we're going to have to do unless something comes up, the Universal Credit doesn't even cover what our monthly bills are at the moment. So it looks like quite a bad situation at the moment. I don't really know what we're going to do.
Paul told us that he was a bit daunted by the process of trying to navigate the universal credit system, and he also wasn't even sure that it would cover his bills.
We'll just have to sort of go without as much and manage on what little savings we have until I can possibly find a job somewhere.
Is the benefit system equipped to handle this kind of crisis?
Think about what's going to happen to someone like Paul, right? He has been on furlough. So 80% of his wages have been paid by Rishi Sunak and co for a few months. He's now going to be unemployed. So he gets two things. One is he can apply for Job Seekers Allowance, which he'll only get for 6 months. And then to help with other things like housing costs and so on, he can get universal credit. He's going to find that he's in a benefit system where the safety net has been absolutely shredded over a period of time. And most recently, it's been shredded by the government in which Boris Johnson was not prime minister, but he was a cabinet minister. It wasn't built for the era of mass unemployment. It's too mean in terms of the money that it pays out, even though Rishi Sunak has topped up a couple of benefits a bit. But it's also too mean in terms of the kind of treatment that it doles out to people. I've reported a lot on what the benefit looks like for those people who go through it. And effectively, you face an obstructive, sometimes bullying bureaucracy. So you've got a welfare system which just isn't used to quote unquote middle class workers coming to it and looking for help.
Coming up, what a jobs crisis could mean for British politics. Aditya, we talked about the downturn of the 80s earlier, and that was transformative for British politics. What do you think this wave of unemployment is going to mean for politics today?
I'd say that actually we've been through a really crazy period in politics for the last 5 years. And a large part of that is down to the economic instability that was brought about in response to the 2008 banking crash.
The day began with the bailout, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor making it clear that the financial system is so important to our society that by saving our banks, we're saving ourselves.
Prime Minister David Cameron warned that the cuts will affect everyone in the country, and he has to make tough decisions.
Now this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance for us to take back control of this country. Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah! And we'll build a country for the many, not the few.
No, Prime Minister, we voted to take back control of our borders.
So if I'm saying that the 2020 depression is going to be far worse than anything we saw in 2008-10, then I expect the political instability that will follow to be worse too.
We're talking in August and we don't have a vaccine yet. Some areas in England have had a second lockdown in recent weeks, and it's very possible that we could get a second national lockdown this winter. What impact would that have on the unemployment levels that we're already seeing?
If you think about it, Boris Johnson has been saying that now you should no longer be working from home. You should be working from the office or the shop floor, wherever you can. Well, he's not going to be saying that if we do go into a second lockdown. It'll be back to staying at home, saving lives and the NHS, as they used to say. So the consequence of that would be to push up unemployment even further.
Are there things that the government could do to try to ease this crisis right now that you would advise if you were in Rishi Sunak's shoes?
The thing about the furlough scheme and ending so abruptly is that it really makes no sense. There's an economist called Paul Gregg, who's kind of like the doyen of Labour economists looking at the jobs market in the UK. And he says that ending the furlough scheme so abruptly is essentially wasting many of the billions of pounds that Rishi Sunak has pumped into keeping businesses and workers afloat. I certainly see a really strong case for keeping furlough going for those sectors which just can't get back to business as usual. If you work in a theatre, a cinema, a cafe or restaurant, you're not going to see the same kind of business levels as you did in February. It seems to me a really massive gamble to be calling an end to the furlough scheme and allowing the prospect of millions of workers going on dole.
Aditya, a lot of what you've told us is pretty dark. And I felt quite sad listening to Paul talk about how he even misses some of the less pleasant aspects of his old job.
It's not something to ever take for granted. It's always been something that I've been glad for, even though you can mourn about having to get up early every morning and things like that. But it's always better having a job than not having one.
Is there any sort of silver lining to this crisis we're in?
If you had a different kind of politics, there's lots of things that could be done. There's no reason you shouldn't extend the furlough scheme. There's no reason why you wouldn't invest You know, now is a time to invest. Investors are paying governments to lend governments money. So there's money out there to be had if you wanted to invest. The other thing I'll say from my reporting on the aftermath of the 2008 crash is that you saw an awful lot of social innovation done by people on the ground. You saw local councils like Preston deciding that the old economic model, which had failed for them, had to be overturned, and they'd start experimenting with creating a new, more localised economy. The same thing in Plymouth, which decided it would start going for creating more social enterprises and cooperatives. The thing about really bad crises is that they can trigger all sorts of ingenuity and innovation, often at ground level. And I think one of the great challenges for people in politics and media is to look out for that kind of fresh thinking and to give it some space and room to grow.
Aditya, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mythili.
That was Aditya Chakraborty. My thanks to him and Paul Fryett. We reached out to Paul's former employer. They told us that his redundancy is still in dispute. They conceded he may be due more money and notice pay and said that they would work to get him everything that he is owed. They also said that the business owner has offered to personally pay Paul while the business struggles to survive. They noted that when Paul came to collect his tools, it was, quote, an awkward scenario, but they said they had tried to talk to him and that there was, quote, nothing sinister. They also added, we were once one of the largest labs in the Northeast and were passionate about creating jobs for Northeast techs. But now we are limping through with a skeleton crew, doing everything we can just to try to stay afloat. Today's episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.